Good afternoon, everyone. This is Alexandra Metters of GalacticConnection.com. And as always, I am trying to find out some very interesting information for all of you out there as to how we can assist this planet into the golden age. And I do believe that I have found two incredible women who have put their heart and soul into assisting this transition through the area of wildlife. I am still in South Africa, and for all of you, if you're not familiar with it, I'm in Botswana today, and it's a place called Tuli, T-U-L-I, if you want to look it up on the map. In the meantime, if you have any other questions, you can go to galacticconnection.com/daily-blog for our daily blogging page for all the current up-and-coming information that's happening that's showing we are making progress for the light. So in the meantime, I would like to introduce Helena Fitchett, and she is originally from Prague, Czechoslovakia Republic. She has a PhD in biology and a bachelor's in accounting, and she used to work with the Center for Rehabilitation of Wildlife, and even before that, for almost 20 years, she owned her own conservation center. Her heart and soul has been in doing anything she possibly can to assist the desecration, the lack of honoring, the lack of consciousness on this planet as to how we treat our animals. And she then was pulled into the Center for Rehabilitation of Wildlife, otherwise known as CROW, as an operational director for 11 years. And then actually became a trustee because she was very well trusted and honored for the incredible amount of work and progress that she's shown. And believe it or not, she was so into it that she and her friend Judy, they ended up cashing in their pensions and thought, what is the best way we can make a change to assist the wildlife on this planet, especially here in incredible South Africa? They ended up buying land in Tuli, Botswana, called Wild at Tuli, and they now own and run their own private game reserve. Now, for all of you out there, you're going to really have some eye openers as to what goes on out here. Some of the information that we're going to be sharing might be a little bit difficult to digest, but there is a point to all of this, and that is the unification of the lightworkers and the wildlife reservationists, I should say, really need to come together and make this change now. I mean, we can't wait any longer. We really need the light workers and the healers and all of you out there that really want to make a change, that have passion in your hearts. This is an incredibly massive need on the planet because, animals heal us and then we heal the world. So with that said, I'm going to bring Helena in. And Helena, I'm so honored to meet you. I was introduced to Helena by my friends Chris and Sandy Wilkins, and it's just been delightful to hear the stories that you shared with me, some of them not so easy to digest, but I feel that this really needs to be shared with the world. There are so many other continents that have absolutely no clue what's really going on. So thank you for coming on today. I appreciate it. So tell us a little bit about coming from the Czech Republic, to South Africa. How old were you when that happened?
I was 17 and a bit, and I was a political refugee from a 1968 revolution, which we had in Czechoslovakia in those days, we were called. And it was a very bloody revolution. My parents got seriously worried, and my father has decided that I need to be basically sent somewhere safe and where there could be a better life. So he did it. I didn't have much say in it.
You were sent by yourself?
I was smuggled out. So we couldn't, nobody, we were always a very small family. My mother has died when I was 9 years old. Yeah. So it was my father and my mother's family who looked after me. So there wasn't a lot, and I'm a single child. Wow. So it was just me, yes.
Well, and thank God for that, right? Because look at what you've done for this planet so far today. I mean, we're really grateful. So you ended up coming directly to Johannesburg, or?
No, we had to be gathered together, all us political refugees, because there were many that year from Czechoslovakia. And we were held in a migration camp for kind of aliens, if you want to put it in an earthly base, aliens. And various countries would screen the people and decide whether they would want to offer a political asylum. And South Africa in those days, they've had a very big drive to bring more white people into South Africa. So they were one of the leading looking in there to see who they can bring in. And I won't bore you with the all details because it's a long story.
Right.
But I needed to leave very quickly because I became very ill. I had a double pneumonia. I needed to, according to an army doctor who looked after us, needed to get out very quickly into somewhere warm because it was October in Vienna, in Austria. That's where we were held.
It was snowing. It's my favorite city.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
I love Vienna.
And if you love Vienna, you would really love Prague.
Oh, and I love that area.
I just said, well, whatever. And that's how I ended up in Johannesburg.
So you've always found yourself in quite shocking
situations,
haven't you?
Yes, definitely.
I mean, especially now, you know. So tell us a little bit about, you know, how did you segue from that into going into preservation of wildlife?
I have always been in love with animals. I think since I was born.
Me too.
And don't ask me to explain it. I do not know. But I know from my family, who it used to be a family joke. And I was 4 years old. Somebody asked me, but what will you do, little girl, when you grow up? And I said, I will be in Africa. And it was like an impossible thing to say. First of all, I was 4 years old and I never heard of Africa. But I must have somewhere. And secondly, we were not even allowed to travel to neighboring countries. We even had to get the permission to travel in the Eastern Bloc.
Yes.
So for me thinking I'm going to be in Africa, it was a family joke to the day I ended up in here. And when I first got a communication from my dad again, it was a postcard. And it said in Czech, so you are in Africa.
Amazing.
So maybe it was my destiny, if there's such thing.
Maybe.
I really couldn't tell you.
Come on, it was your destiny.
And I am very happy that I ended up in Africa. I probably would have worked myself into Africa some way anyhow, because I always wanted to be in Africa. And my father's family was involved with the Prague Zoo as a veterinarian. And I used to spend most of my weekends in this zoo. And one day, I was still small enough to get between the bars in an elephant enclosure. So I snuck through there, and this huge, big mother elephant has decided that I was very cute. And she kept me between her front legs. Needless to say, when they finally find me, I was told that there was fire department, police, you name it. Everybody on a standby, because everybody waiting for this elephant to squash me. And it never did.
That is such an omen.
They eventually snatched me, I believe, from the elephant with a keeper trying to distract her with all the tasty bits she liked. She didn't want to let me go. I was there like, from what I understood from my dad, like for 2 hours.
Well, and I want the audience to understand that Helena is definitely an elephant whisperer, and she's going to tell you a little bit about that in a minute. But anyway, go ahead.
So maybe there was somewhere, maybe there was somewhere a destiny waiting.
Absolutely.
And I don't regret it. I think when I look back, I think I was born in the wrong country.
Mm-hmm.
I hate cold.
Mm-hmm.
I don't like too many people and big cities.
Yeah,
I don't think I would have been happy where I was.
That's fantastic. So you took, basically, life took a really horrible situation and created you into exactly where you belong, you know? Mm. Well, so let's fast forward. I know that you and Judy, your partner, you yes. ended up deciding to cash in your pensions to actually make this dream come true. Can you tell us a little more about that?
Well, it's fairly drastic and simple. We've decided we needed to buy land in order to preserve the land and in its entirety. The unspoiled environment where animals can have a sanctuary. It's not really a sanctuary, but sanctuary in the terms that we will protect it and look after it. Of course, the land, wildlife land, apart from the national parks, which belong to government, is very, very expensive in Southern Africa because hunters covet the land in order to hunt the wildlife, and they pay a very big prices for such land. So the best places we wanted to be, we could not afford. That was totally out of our league. Pooling together, we could afford something, and we managed to find, I knew this area from time before where I came around and little bit work around, so I knew it well, and I saw the advert in one of the agriculture magazines and it mentioned Julie, and I found this person. It was a Motswana people who owned this land, and they, when they told me where the land is, I knew straight away where the land was.
Oh, interesting. And I so said, were you aware of the wildlife that was already on the land?
Absolutely, absolutely. But I knew that it was destroyed, a lot of it, because they were hunting, because there were farmers with a cattle, and they would shoot out all the predators. Mm. I knew it was neglected, and it was in need of care. So I told Judy about the land, and Judy said, oh my God, I can't go because I don't have a passport. Her passport, I can't remember, expired or there was something. So I said, but I need to go because the land is out there. So bless the Judy. She said to me, well, you go. I trust you. You must just tell me what did you find. And I came here by myself and I look. And I saw not many animals. It wasn't great, but I saw spoor on the ground, and I found every conceivable animal I knew should be living here, spoor on the ground, including a lion spoor at the back.
So when you say that, bed. Dead?
No. Well,
or just no, emaciated? No, just, like
no, no, spoor. It's a footprint.
Oh, got it. Okay.
Okay. And when I came back, Judy said to me, what is it like? And I said, well, I think it's okay. It needs love and care because it's neglected. But everything is there, albeit in a very small numbers. Judy said to me, did you find a bubes? Bubes is a Zulu word for a male lion. Mm. And I said, yes, I find the pugmark, big one, in a dry riverbed. She said, that's it, I'm in. She hasn't even saw the land. She bought the land with me.
That's amazing.
And then eventually she was able to come. And we then decided that this is our part or our contribution to protecting the last few remaining truly wild places around this planet.
Yeah, definitely.
And it's a small contribution we can make with our capacity of what we can do, because you can't save the whole world.
Right. But you are making an imprint, and energetically that will travel across the world. So hopefully today people are going to have a lot more clarity on exactly what's going on with the wildlife, especially particularly here in South Africa. So once you got, and it's called Wild at Thule, right? Which I love. So how many, and you use the word hectares, how many hectares are there?
We've got about 1,800 hectares. We run it together with another three.
Okay.
So we run it as a unit of nearly 5,000 hectares.
Wow.
And then we now been helping to take care of next door property, which is 8,200 hectares.
Whoa.
On top of that. So it's a nice chunk of a land, which hopefully we can try to somehow protect.
So give us a synopsis of exactly what type of wildlife exists here at this point.
This is what they call in Africa Big Five area, which means that you have the predators, cheetah, leopard, lion. You have elephant. There are some rhino, not on our property, on neighboring properties.
Really?
Because of the rhino poaching, they have to be fenced.
It's terrible.
It's unstoppable at the moment here. We don't have a buffalo because when they come here from Zimbabwe side, because our government is very paranoid over their beef contract with Europe, they will shoot the buffalo because they worried that a buffalo will transmit foot and mouth disease to cattle, and cattle is what they sell to Europe.
Interesting.
So we don't have a buffalo, albeit they normally would occur here. And we're not allowed to have a buffalo. We're supposed to report when we see them.
Now that's a little different than the wildebeest.
That's different,
right?
To wildebeest,
totally different.
Yes.
Okay.
Much bigger animal.
Okay.
It's a bovine. Wildebeest is antelope.
Interesting. And you have all different types of antelope I saw. In fact, I saw a leopard last night, and that just made my world. Just
it's
watching
awesome.
Her, she was gorgeous.
Yeah. And to think that people actually actively shoot them out. People hunt them here. And only way you can hunt a leopard is that you bait them. Because, and forgive me, we're talking to American audience, but most of our predators are actually shot by Americans. And because they are the one who can afford the prices the people charge for this. And what they do, because a hunter comes for two to three weeks safari and want to shoot this animal, in order to guarantee this animal, they will bait, they will kill animals and hang them up in special place. And the leopard will, over the 2-3 months, learn to come back there for food.
Because it smells it. Okay.
Because it smells it. So when the hunter is ready to come, it is guaranteed for him that he will shoot that leopard. But it's not a sport. That animal is baited.
Of course not.
It's not. Any killing is actually not a sport.
Right.
You cannot call that a sport.
Tell me a little bit. The other day you were sharing some of the statistics that were pretty mind-blowing, and you were talking about the population of the wildlife versus the people. Can you go over that?
Talking about people, if I recall.
Yeah, the population.
The population explosion is absolutely horrific. In East Africa, in the last 100 years, the population expanded by something like 74%. In West Africa, it's 82%. It is scary because no economy on the planet can possibly provide the job opportunities and reasonable living for those people. It's simply not possible. The pace, one outstrips the other by such large margin that it's not possible.
And especially the fact that they don't really know how to farm. You know, were mentioning how they really don't even want to be doing all this farming.
They don't want to be doing a farming, but there are a number of reasons for that. One of them is that there is this part of Africa, south of equator, is really a lot of countries are periodically drought-stricken. And the rains here are very sporadic. So these people would not risk putting a fortune in a fertilizer, because fertilizer is very expensive, into the field and not to reap anything.
Mm.
So they prefer not to do it. So there is that reason. The African people are not into commercial farming. You hardly find, you will battle to find a large-scale commercial farmers, which would be African people. It's not in their nature. Mm-hmm. They farm for just themselves and a family on a very subsistence level. And that's how they're comfortable. They're comfortable in that. They provide just for themselves and their family.
It's funny because in the United States, so much has been brought to all big, huge commercial farming, which we are looking very much down upon, because they're controlling the GMOs, you know, the quality of the soil, that kind of thing, and they really just could care less. You know?
There is a bit of that in Africa too, of course, because this is where the food is being produced by a very large commercial scale farming. It's always a foreigners in charge of it and running it.
Very
because they are the one who have funds as well as the skills to do it. You know, when you think of it, in we were talking back to the people in 2003, some world humanitarian organization did a census of demographic in African continent, and they find out that 40% of all people are below the age of 15. That in itself already poses you a problem, that there is not enough skilled workforce who could possibly even help to create those jobs. They are children.
Mm-hmm.
And they are children who now, most of them, lost the, perhaps the parents to HIV, and they now need to look after themselves. They don't have a time to go and experiment in growing something or even actually trying to go to school. Some of them try to finish their matric and they're 28 years old.
Wow.
So it's really is complicated. It's complicated here. It's not a straightforward cut line.
Now, the part about the statistics that really baffled me was when you were talking about the culling, right? Isn't that what you refer to it as? And I want everyone to understand that because of you, they are no longer allowed, correct, to cull the elephants in the country of Botswana.
It's not just because of me. There's three of us involved in it. I had a fellow researcher called Myra Barnes, who is also Dr. Myra Barnes. She's an American.
Fantastic.
And she came from Reno, from Nevada.
Oh my gosh, it's close to where I live. Mm.
And there was another American lady, so there were two Americans. Her name is Lynn Darrock. And she wasn't a researcher, but she was just completely passionate about Africa. And she was completely passionate about lions and elephants. And she spent every moment of her life she could coming back to Africa. And we used to go on a safari together. She was a very good photographer.
Mm.
And she compiled the photographic record of things.
Fantastic.
So she also helped us to fundraise in America to support some years, because the research took nearly 10 years into trying to, we didn't try to prove that the elephants should not be culled. The beginning of the research had to do with the trees. And then it swung now with tree, which is a key species. In savannah, it's called Acacia araloba. And it's a tree which elephants, in a harsh time of winter, survive on.
Oh, really?
Not entirely, but it is key species. It's very high in protein, the pots. It's got a big, fluffy pot.
It has thorns on it, right?
All acacias,
yeah.
We're not supposed to call them acacias now, because Australians have decided that the only acacia on this planet is in Australia. So at the moment, there's a big scientific argument who is allowed to call them acacia. But at my time, we still call them acacia, and it's Acacia araloba. And from that, it span on to the elephants. And on an end, one of the culling argument was that there is far too many elephants in a Chobe riverfront and up there in that corner of Botswana. And they are completely ruining a vegetation of a riverfront, and there's no new rejuvenation of the riverine, all blamed on elephants.
Mm.
And throughout this research, it came very obvious that they actually have nothing to do with it, or very little to do with
it.
The biggest impact was large herds of buffalo who trampled the seedlings. And then whatever seedlings did germinate it in a dry of the winter, impala ate them. So, in fact, it was an elephant which rejuvenated the forest further down where those animals were not, by carrying seeds in their dung. And it all made a big sense. And we've made a plea through that to a government at the time. And government, which Botswana government does understand that their wealth is wildlife. And they are, I think they've got 17% of the entire Botswana is set aside for wildlife areas, which is one of the highest in the world, except Alaska, I think.
Really?
So that's commendable, and they've decided that there wasn't good enough reason to cull elephants. But that could change. It's not going to last forever. There's now some talk, starting again, of elephant culling. As the land shrink, there's more people.
But for the last 3 years, you've successfully stopped that, right?
No, this happened quite a long time ago. We're talking, I tell you exact, 89. So this is a long time ago. It was a CITES conference where this was going to be debated. And it was the one where we managed to get elephant on Appendix 1, CITES. That is the Appendix 1 is that you're not allowed to trade in that animal and its product whatsoever reason. Good. So it's a 100% protection.
Good.
However, last CITES meeting, they downgraded elephant to Appendix 2, which means that you can deal with this animal and its products in a controlled manner. Very simply explaining it, obviously it's more to it, but I'm just trying to give it to...
Yeah, just keep it simple. Now,
what actually happened then, in anticipation of that, because remember, you're in Africa.
Right.
Everything is bribable here. Mm. So there is no way you can control that trade to be legal. Truly, absolutely no way. And in anticipation of this, I have to tell you that as you and me sit here, there is up to 40 elephants a day already being poached in East Africa. In anticipation of being able to use that ivory.
It's almost as if, you know, somebody's always looking to point the finger and blame a species, an elephant, or a lion, or a water buffalo, or what have you, when we're not looking at the culprit themselves, which is humanity, and the
Absolutely.
Way in which we're... And I feel like, first of all, if you could clarify what culling is for the people that are not aware of that term.
Culling is systematic killing of elephants.
Okay.
There's somebody in government will decide how many. In the past, we have tried to be, people try to tell us that it is sought through and the numbers are established correctly. We since have found out that this is not a case. It's very difficult to establish how many elephants you have because they are very far roaming creatures. Mm. If there wouldn't be some of the fences, the elephant will travel and be known to go 1,000 kilometers in another land. So it's a moving population. Elephants are moving population. Up in the northern Botswana, they move between Namibia, Botswana, Zambia, and Zimbabwe. So they traverse 4 countries and depend on the rainfall. One year there are huge amount of elephants in Botswana, and the next year they all gone to Zambia and Zimbabwe because there is better food and better rain. So it's very difficult for one country to say, this year we've had 150,000 elephants, so we're going to cull 70,000.
Now, you also mentioned the statistics on that as well, where you determined the growth rate of the elephants. It's completely disproving their argument. Can you share that with us?
Well, if you take the place like Acholi, which is a little bit more controlled than others, it's much smaller. And there have been, since mid-60s, always an effort to try to determine what is the elephant population here. If you take the number of years from the mid-60s up to now, where in mid-60s there was around somewhere 660 elephants in this area. Today we have got same area 1,500 elephants. Mm. So they just gone a little bit over double in 40 years plus.
Nothing.
If you break it really down, it's possibly 3% gross rate a year, which is nothing. You cannot, they get poached more every year than that. So you're not even replacing at this stage what we are losing.
And you also said, you know, now you did mention the fencing, which is really screwing up like their very old pathways that they follow. They tend to follow these pathways, and if there's a fence there, then they can't get to where they're used to going. What do they do in those cases?
Well, if they go through that fence, they are shot. That's it.
And they're such a large animal. I've been wanting to ask you this. They're such a large animal that it would take a ton of bullets to bring them down.
No, one shot, if you're good at that. Most of the authorities are not good at that. So average elephant being killed will probably, well, I have seen anything up to 10 bullets.
Good God. And it's just an anguishing death. Because,
it's horrid.
Yeah, I've seen documentaries. Mm. I just sobbed when I saw it.
It's horrid.
And now
but what they do with culling, culling is the one of the cruel thing you have ever seen in your life. I have, through my work in wildlife, I have been once upon the time asked to a witness the culling and report on the welfare, animal welfare side of it, which was one of the most horrific things I have ever seen in my life. Okay. They use a drug on an elephant, which is not a tranquilizer, it's immobilizer. There's a very big difference. They normally shoot them from helicopter with the immobilizer. At least now they take out the whole family because they know they cannot just take one or two members because elephants grieve so much that it causes a really terrible suffering. Some of them will die through grieving.
Yeah, I've seen that too.
So what they do, they shoot them with this immobilizer. They often use a drug called M99. Now what immobilizer does, it's a muscle immobilizer. So you cannot move, but you can feel, hear, smell, and see everything. So, and the elephant goes down very quickly. It immobilizes you relatively quickly. So once all the elephants are down on the ground, then they go with rifles over them and they shoot them in a brain shot usually. It's absolutely horrid. Small babies are then caught and sold to whoever.
And pulled away from their families.
Yeah. Well, they don't have families anymore. They're busy suckling mother with the blood running down out of her. And it is the biggest horror story you can ever imagine.
Now, tell the audience also about, I know North Rhodesia and South Rhodesia is now Zambia and
Zimbabwe. Zambia is in Northern Rhodesia,
Zimbabwe,
Southern
right?
Rhodesia is Zimbabwe.
Okay, so there's been war up there in the past.
Yes.
Can you tell us a little bit about how that's affected the elephant population?
Well, it was a similar like in Mozambique, except it was more intense in Zimbabwe. And the terrorist war throughout Zimbabwe was horrendous because there were many landmines. The army fed off the wildlife and elephants because and that's happening throughout Africa, because they would not feed the soldiers. To this day, now, as you're sitting here, President Mugabe shoots elephant to feed the army. Now, right now, 21st century.
Now, isn't this the same president that's telling them to shoot all whites?
Absolutely.
Right?
Okay. He's a completely madman.
Yeah.
But he's been there for a very long time. He's brought the country to its knees.
Yeah, it's in bad shape.
The people are starving. Yeah. It's a beautiful country. It used to have such wealth of wildlife.
It's a gorgeous country. And the part that was very starking, clear to me, is as we were driving up to the ruins, Zimbabwe ruins, you know, and I saw all the donkeys and the cattle and the goats and the sheep occasionally. Walking along, I mean, there were dead animals just sitting there everywhere, and they were so thin, so thin. Mm. And I thought, oh, and then you look at the people, and they're very, very thin.
People are starving in Zimbabwe. They are suffering. But this is the trouble with African countries. People are completely stoic and completely, they will not question, unless there is a war. Mm-hmm. They don't know any middle way. They don't understand democracy like we do. that you can actually get somebody out of the office.
Yeah.
They will respect the authority no matter who it is. If it's bad, it's bad. They just wait until the person dies. And this is what's been happening with Zimbabwe. Nobody wants Mugabe. On the street, you speak to people. They don't want this man because they know the damage he has done. But nobody will do anything about it. We went with Judy a couple of years ago along the Zimbabwe-Botswana border in a very remote road. You don't even know whether you're in Zimbabwe or in Botswana. Mm-hmm. And it was the entire area as we were driving through was littered with spent bullets and shotgun cartridges as people are just killing everything which moves. Oh, and that's 2 years ago, 3 years ago. What was it, Judy, 3 years ago? Yeah.
It's crazy. That's so crazy.
And they don't get paid. Soldiers don't get paid. So they must just feed off the elephants. And when we always know when we get an elephant here because it gets so traumatized from Botswana. It is so angry. It is so against people. You straight away know. We've got a new elephant here. He managed to come through from Zimbabwe.
Tell everybody a little bit about how you communicate with the elephants. I think it's very interesting.
I think it's an understanding of elephants. Mm-hmm. I don't think somehow it's a gift, unless I'm wrong.
I think it's because
I have been with them for so many years. I have watched elephants and been with elephants one way or the other for the last 40 years. So if he blinks the eyelash, I know why is mm-hmm. he blinking it. And I think that's how, because you understand the body language. You understand how they work in their mind, how their infrastructure is, how they relate to each other. And if you then respect that and treat them the same way, you kind of get an understanding what is going to happen next.
Yes.
And
well, okay, so tell them the story about the mother and her two babies that were caught in the mud, because I think that's a very key way of understanding how they truly are communicating with us. And
I
especially
think,
the way that in which they handled you. I mean, that was
yes, I think it's a lesson for us mm-hmm. to realize that animals do communicate, perhaps differently than we do. They don't have a language. Their language is different. They don't speak. But they certainly, for me, most of the animals have souls, are enlightened. Elephants particularly.
Very much so.
Are an animal which I think many people can take a lot of examples from. We were in an area called Savuti quite a few years back. And it was a drought, so the water holes were drying out. And most of the deep water holes in Africa have a lot of mud at the bottom because elephants rub themselves and dust themselves, and they go in the water to swim, and all that mud washes away. So it's a very fine clay, and it dries into clay. You can make a pottery out of it. And animals were being trapped in this one waterhole, and lions, of course, were waiting there every day and were able to kill them and eat them. But it's not easy to kill an elephant in a mud. So an elephant one night was eaten alive, took a long time for it to die, and we had to listen to that. It was really horrid. And it wasn't exactly the next day, it was a day after. We went past this waterhole, and there were three elephants stuck. It was a small family. It was a mother and sub-adult calf, female, and then there was this young bull calf. He might have been about 2 years.
Oh.
And they were solid, stuck in a mud. They were not moving. And in Africa, at 42 degrees in the shade, that mud starts caking in very, very quickly. And I had one look at this and decided there's no way I am going to allow this animal to be there because the lions were everywhere. This is going to be a horror story. Yeah. So I went and tried to appeal for help to a couple of lodges. They were non-interested because they had guests and guests took a priority. far as I was concerned, guess they can go to hell. And anyhow, so I took it upon myself as a friend, and we managed to engage a couple of local people who agreed we were going to pay them for a day. They're going to come and help us. And we labored from about 8 o'clock in the morning until about 3 in the afternoon. We have having to bring this a big 20,000-liter tank of water and keep on pouring it just to soften the mud, because you couldn't bother and get them out. They were solid. And we managed to get a youngster out first because it was the smallest, so he was the easiest job. But of course, he caused a huge problem, because the minute he was out, he wanted to go back to its mum, and its mum was stuck in a mud.
Right.
So we had to try to keep on chasing him and keeping him away from there. And by that time, there was a number of elephants gathered around us. Some really big bulls up in that area of Botswana. I mean, you get 6-ton bulls. They're huge.
Wow.
And they look quite menacing, but they're gentle.
Yeah.
And these bulls, which were first to Araf on the scene, later on whole families with females Araf as well, they not only not hurt us, and I promise you there were times where we bumped into them because they didn't go out of the way.
Amazing.
They knew we were helping. Eventually they realized that we're trying to keep this youngster away. They kept him away. They kept on surrounding him and pushing him a little bit, and surrounding him and pushing him. And eventually the youngster got the message and stayed with them. Then we managed to get the female, the suffered out female, out. Once she was out, it became easier because the young brother stayed with her. And then all the other elephants started to arrive. We were eventually surrounded by elephants. There must have been, I don't know, 30, 50 elephants around us.
Incredible.
Not one elephant shown any aggression towards us. And we were like, really pay no attention to them. We were so stressed to try to get this female out.
Right.
Because when elephant lies too long on its side, their rib cage compresses.
Wow.
And it will actually kill them. The heart can't carry on beating.
Wow.
So I knew that we were running out of time. And by 3 o'clock afternoon, I was panicking. I was thinking we're going to have to try to get somebody to shoot her, because I wasn't going to let her to be eaten alive.
Yeah, exactly like that.
But then, for last effort, we went and fetched a last load of water, and I took the whole lot of water in 2 buckets, and I actually got through the mud and sat on top of her. And she could touch me with her trunk. She kept on smelling my hair, smelling my hands, kept on putting my hand over her eye and making her cool. I gave her water to drink. And again, she could have flung me 30 meters up in the air with that trunk.
Yes.
She could have squashed me, crushed me. She did not do a thing.
She just
kept on sniffing.
They knew.
She knew I was actually helping us, not hurting her.
Yeah.
We did manage to get her out. We did broke one of her tusks, however, because it's very difficult. We had to try to put chains on her to pull. Mm. And but that was a small damage.
Yeah. No,
and she was really exhausted. She stood for quite a while. We stayed there with her. I burned a clutch on my car, burned a winch on my car.
Wow.
We've had
crazy.
Quite a bit of damage. But the next day we came to look at another waterhole which had a water, and she came with her Sapadal daughter and this youngster, and it was so lovely to see. She was tired still, you could see. Mm-hmm. It was a big ordeal for her.
Yeah.
But they were 100%. So it was, and I can't describe it. It was a communication without words.
Yes.
Everybody kind of knew where they belong in this drama, including the elephant.
And it's almost as if when they enclosed you, they were sending their own love and support of what you were doing, because they get it.
Yeah, and they were talking to that female, and she was talking back to them. She was rumbling back to them. So whatever they were saying, I couldn't tell you, but they most certainly kind of made us, you know, those people are helping. They're one of us. Don't hurt them.
And probably prompting her to hang in there.
I hope so. She did hang in there. It was touch and go, but she did hang in there all day.
So it's fantastic that you have some success stories. Now, I know that you were saying that the cattle farming here has created quite a bit of controversy and also a clashing between those that want to support the wildlife. And can you give people a little bit of a background on that in South Africa?
Yes. This area initially, obviously, no, let's start from the beginning. The first, it was a wildlife area. But then the farmers moved in, and the European farmers decided this would be a good place to raise the cattle. It's not a good place because of the droughts. It's also very rocky, and there were a lot of predators. So they shot out everything which had teeth. Absolutely everything. That didn't help because a drought killed a cattle as well. Right. So it wasn't just lions and hyenas, it was also a drought. This place doesn't have enough grass most time of the year. So eventually the farmers moved out after they have actively hunted this area to almost nothing. The elephants, in fact, in Chile, there is a elephant population with least tusks in southern Africa because tusk size of the elephant is genetic, not people's height.
Oh.
Tall people have tall children, short people have short children.
Right.
And they've shot out the gene here for a large tusk because they shot the elephants for tusk to sell. So there's a lot of tuskless elephants here in Chile, which is unusual. You don't see as many anywhere else.
You know what else is interesting about that? It's almost as if because they're so intelligent and they knew that they'd been hunted for the tusks, it's almost like nature's way of, in a weird way, protecting them. That's really very interesting.
When we came in here, farmers just move out. They've left all the wire lying around so animals get their legs caught. Mm. So we do actually also run a program where we send out young people who come and visit us from all over the world. And they do a lot of physical work, apart from a nice conservation work. But they remove the wire.
Good.
We try to remove as much as we can, and I'm talking truckloads by now, because it's causing terrible problems with wildlife. They get their legs snared in it, and we've had elephants which cut the trunk off. So it's causing a problem. So we're trying to tackle that as well. But going back to your question about the predators, yes. There are still left a few people who have with wildlife on their farm, livestock.
Mm-hmm.
And lions, obviously, will try and go as a prey. The car is a lot easier than an antelope. Oh, they're slower, they're not as wise, and they will...
Okay, so we just got interrupted by a very positive phone call.
Yes, that was indeed.
Some possible funding through the United Nations?
Yes, it's for the community land, which is also, we're hoping, going to be protected.
That would be awesome.
But going back to a war zone between the cattle owners and the predators, the problem here is that they're not many. There are three left, but they persist with keeping a cattle in a wildlife areas, which in itself, it's a problem because a cattle is very slow and compared to antelope, very stupid. So they don't protect themselves as well or run away as fast as the wildlife.
Do you happen to know the names of the three cattle farms?
I don't know the names. We just deal with the people.
Okay.
Yeah,
just curious.
Strangely enough, the two people out of three have just died. But their family, and I mean just, like one died I think about 3 weeks ago, 4 weeks ago, and one died about 2 months ago. But we're hoping that the farm will be for sale, to somebody who's not going to be a cattle farmer.
Good.
It's not going to be that their family takes up the cattle farming. Yeah. But it's a constant a war between the two. They trap, kill, and poison all the predators. Trouble is with snaring, we call it a snare. It's a wire noose which gets strategically placed on the ground. They also use a gin traps still, which are illegal. Nobody checks on it. And the problem is that it's not selective. Many other animals get caught in this. So it's a real carnage. And we have offered out of our personal funds, I think that's why we're not fabulous, Larry, that we will compensate, top up the government compensation if it's not enough for every cow which gets killed and proven to be killed by lion.
Right.
However, one of the first things we started doing was looking into how they keep the animals safe at night. Well, they don't. The cattle is left roaming everywhere. The actual enclosures, the crawls which they have to keep the cattle in, it's got holes in it that you can drive the bus through.
Oh, interesting.
So and the lamb can just walk in and hyena and help themselves.
Very sure.
Yeah. So we've endeavored, we've got donation of some fencing, and we have got our young volunteers again, and we actually build a proper night enclosure, they call it a crawl in Africa, for this cows. And since we've done it, there haven't been an incident of lion taking a cow. But it is something which you will never, ever resolve, in my opinion. Through working with wildlife all these years, I do not believe wildlife and people mix, because there is so much area of conflict just by the, each of their mere presence.
Mm-hmm.
The person who is going to, even if you grow a crop, even if you grow a maize, well, the baboons will come and steal it. It's food for them.
Right.
They don't know it's yours.
Right.
Even antelope, dhaka, will come and eat it. If you grow fruit, elephants will come and take it. It really doesn't mix. Wildlife and wildlife areas, I truly believe, should be left alone. And should be protected and coveted like we covet works of art.
So basically, the only people that should be moving into these locations are those that are going to work to protect the animals.
All visitors.
Not a civilized, you know, city or village environment at all.
We've been very much trying to promote these peace parks, which are happening in Africa. Unfortunately, they are taking very long time. The one in Natal in South Africa has taken nearly 40 years to even come to anything. However, they are a wonderful solution. What it is, the idea, it is that we create a corridors which remain wild between the places where animals traditionally migrate when they need to.
Right.
So, like from here, this is proposed to become a Shasha Limpopo Transfrontier Park.
Interesting.
It hasn't happened yet because of the Zimbabwe, because if all our animals walk through the Zimbabwe, they get eaten and shot. Well, this is what's holding it back at the moment, and people are very reluctant to buy into this idea. Also because of the Mozambique, where they're actively poaching, there are same fears. But the idea is that there is an ancient corridor between us and a coast where animals used to go in time of droughts that swings back down into Natal, into South Africa, to Lake St. Lucia system. And it's a fantastic idea. We already have a Kalahari Transfrontier Park, which encompasses the Botswana and South Africa and a portion of Namibia. So it is the way forward to try to do that. But the biggest problem is people. Mm-hmm. You have to move people out of this trans frontier park, and people don't want to be moved.
Of course not. Yeah.
Even if they are going into better area.
Right.
Because there is a lot of... It's not really religion. It is probably spiritual. Because they want to live where their ancestors are buried.
Okay.
So it becomes quite a difficult issue to resolve, but you cannot have a village in the middle of the wildlife area because right. that conflict will continue to be there. And if you have to make a choice as a person in charge, you're obviously not going to choose to shoot the person.
Right.
You're going to have to choose to shoot whoever, be it elephant or lion.
Yeah.
So it's also taking its toll on wildlife, a huge toll in Africa. I know that in America, I know from our fellow wildlife rehabilitators that if you hit a deer, you can call a helicopter and they'll come and collect it.
Mm-hmm.
Here, you hit anything, it dies or you shoot it. So we're not sophisticated mm-hmm. enough to protect our wildlife here.
Right.
We don't have the resources. We don't have a... we don't even have a skill enough people to want to do it.
It's almost as if you need to develop your own process, your own service. Because I do see, it has been shocking for me to see a lot of the dead animals lying on the side of the road. I mean, just, you know, bloated from the sun and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And not actively, you know, because that can cause disease and all that. And not actively being picked up and removed. I did see a family, I believe it was in Botswana, over towards Mound, and I did see that there was a sheep that had been hit on the side of the road, and I saw the mother, the child was standing over it, the father was standing there, and I could tell that they were, if it had just been hit, they were actually thinking, hey, this is dinner.
Good food.
This is dinner tonight because it's fresh.
Yes.
You know? And I thought, well, good that it's going into some sort of good use, you know, but... It was a very clear representation that even though we aren't seeing all of this in the more metropolitan areas, you know, these atrocities are still going on. We need to support them energetically as best as we can, which is one of the reasons I'm interviewing you today. So
you know, it's also unfortunately the world is money.
Yeah.
It's very sad,
very
so,
true.
But you just cannot get anywhere without the money because everything costs.
Yeah.
And in Africa, if you take a place like America, where there are so many millions of people working and everybody kind of makes a reasonable living or reasonable existence, okay, compared to here.
Okay, yeah, because
I'm comparing
not that
to
great.
Here.
No. It's just
but,
really not.
Nobody lives in a mud hut.
Right.
And no water, no electricity, and no nothing.
Yeah.
So compared to here, let's put it this way.
I agree.
And the problem is that you need to get money somewhere for all this work. This Center for Rehabilitation of Wildlife, I work for, one of the biggest problem was that governments in Africa do not recognize animal as a welfare. They tell us, they used to write us, they say, sorry, animals are not the welfare issue. Finish. When we ever ask for support, financial support, animals is not a welfare issue. People are welfare issue, not animals. So you have to fundraise from the public, and that's what we did. This is what you did. Fundraising from people on the street, and we had to find a lot of money. We even threw about 1.6 million every year. And that was just covering the cost. Mm-hmm. That's not for anything else we needed to do.
Right.
So now you imagine, now this is in South Africa, where there's still a lot more people who live an existence where they can give you extra 10, 20 rand.
Right.
Here, there's absolutely nobody who will give you money for animal welfare. These people would think that you're completely mad.
It's a completely because different thought process.
Also, it's different needs. These people, if they're going to have extra 10 rand, they're going to buy something for their own family. Not for a dog on a street,
right,
or for a lion in a bush. Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. So it's very difficult to do any kind of animal welfare work in Africa because all the funding, if there are people who are doing it, comes from overseas.
So basically,
doesn't come from here.
The most successful funding is going to be from outside this country.
Absolutely, because people can afford to give it.
And probably the most successful assistance on a physical level, being here to help the two of you do all that needs to be done, is probably outside this country. Can you talk a little bit about that? Just some of the realizations you've had about the volunteers and the attitudes of South Africa.
I think most people, we are in a partnership with a company called Projects Abroad from a UK. They are the people who send young people all over the world to have kind of a work experience, be it a humanitarian, be it a conservation. And they come for up to 3 months to stay here and get involved with whatever we do. It's a great help. We try to... We are conservation projects. We don't do humanitarian issues. I don't apologize for that. I think when people do humanitarian issues, that's their calling and they do it real well. My calling is animals, and I hope I'm doing that real well. And I don't think I would like to dilute my efforts.
Sure.
And that's how I feel. So we only do conservation.
Well, I would think that's logical anyway, because there's just so much to do
for
the conservation of wildlife. You know?
There is. So we've decided we're going to be very pure to that cause. This is what we do. We don't mix the two. We don't try to go and... We do help village around here. We painted their schools. Our people go and meet the people in the village and learn some of their craft. But that's how far we go.
Right.
The rest of our efforts is concentrated on wildlife. Our young people who come here, we try, okay, because I do not know how successful we are, but we try to make them think. I cannot tell them what to do, but I run a conservation lectures in a way of thought-provoking.
Good.
As opposed to telling them what's wrong and right and telling them what to do because they can choose not to listen.
Right.
So I try to do a thought provoking for them that they realize how they live in a society which is governed by consumer goods, by money. You can't eat and drink your money on the end of the day.
And also oppression and starvation.
Oppression, starvation, all of that. And they don't even know about it. This is the fascinating part for me, and very sad one, actually. I find it sometimes quite depressing that I get a bright young people, and we can get up to 30 a day in a busy season. So
Excellent.
We go through a lot of young people from all over the world.
Excellent.
They have no idea of pain and suffering of this world. They have no idea of how they are part of it. Mm-hmm. That's the worst part. Mm-hmm. They are part of that suffering. They don't need 3 computers. They can only have one. Because all what they do is a Facebook and a blog or whatever they do. I have no idea.
Right.
But the wastefulness of the society. This life where I'm okay, Jack. Damn you. That seemed to be the order of the day,
yes.
Where I'm going to do it because I want to do it. And if I don't, someone else will do it. So why shouldn't I do it? There is no more what I find very clear line, moral and ethical lines, between of what you should do for your surrounding. The old-fashioned giver. Attitude seems to be going. People are takers today, mostly.
Well, and that is unfortunate because it really starts from the cradle. And So you and I were kind of talking about that yesterday, where how do you teach somebody to have character? How do you teach somebody to have a conscious consideration for animals? And I actually presented to you, hey, have you done educational seminars with the local blacks here, just to kind of give them a different perspective of how animals provide us healing, provide us knowledge and wisdom and reflection?
We have, and I have, because when I was working for Center for Rehabilitation of Wildlife, one of the things we did not allow public in, because animals are wild and they cannot be habituated to people if you're going to release them again. But what we did do, we used to bring underprivileged schools in on limited basis. We did educational videos. We provided them with a day of trying to show them that these animals are part of their heritage, basically, and you need them spiritually. You need these animals. We have had very bad success with that, because you are talking to still a people who, animal is there to be eaten. Mm-hmm. Be it a domestic animal, they never feed their dogs. They never feed their cat. Dog must feed itself. That's why there is so much wildlife killed around the villages, because the dogs go out hunting.
Yeah.
They have not brought animals into their culture as something they spiritually need. That hasn't happened yet. Maybe it will happen futuristically, but at the moment, the need is such that if there is an animal, it is to be beast of burden. Donkey is going to be pulling a car.
Yeah,
or it's to be that I need food, and I need, therefore, this animal for my food. It's a difficult one. I've tried this for 12 years, and we had many. In fact, we had 1 year 6,000 children through our center.
Wow.
A lot, really a lot. And they are still, as we talk now, continue with our work on underprivileged schools. I wasn't going to give it up just because I see it as unsuccessful, but it's got to continue. But as I am here now, it was not successful, and it still isn't.
I would just counter that by saying, just one kid that grows up to say, you know, to be 18, and always remembers that lecture or that series that so impacted them, because there has to be someone out there within their culture that is seeing the strangeness, the complexity, the disparity between the, you know, there has to be that one that gets that calling. It's just, in my opinion, it's just the way the divinity works, especially when there's such a crisis going on.
I have so pacified myself with that sort for years. Otherwise, I would have given it up.
I used to think, tough guy.
1 out of 100, if I get 1 out of 100, I'm doing marvelously. That's how I used to think. And I still think that when I talk to the volunteers here.
And one thing I want to say to the audience is, this is another reason that we're doing this interview, is to appeal. There are many of you that write in to me, and you are craving within your being of, what can you do to make a difference? What can you do to reach a state of elevation within yourself? You know, a high, an ecstasy, knowing that something you did really impacted the planet in a big way. And this is one of those areas. And so if there are anybody out, if there's anyone out there that's listening to this radio show who feels like, hey, I just want to chalk it all up. I don't want to be in corporate America. I don't want to work, you know, 10 to 12 hours a day. I don't want to sit in traffic. I'm tired of my life and the superficiality of it and the shallowness of it. Really consider South Africa and consider contacting Helena Fitchett, because they have fantastic programs here. They can really use the work and talk about a fulfilling life. And knowing that you're really making a difference. One of the other things that you had shared with me was, this is kind of an intense story, but I feel like it needs to be shared with a lot of people so that they understand how crucial the crisis is and how badly the world needs to assist South Africa at this time. I was wondering if you could share what happened the other day with the bull that accidentally went into the farm. I mean, you don't have to go into the gruesome details because I was sobbing, folks. But people need to be aware that if you want to help, your donations, your presence here as a volunteer could really make a huge difference. So
I will tell you about the bull, but I would like to just pick up on what you said.
Sure.
That one of the biggest difference people can do is to pressurize the government. Because governments seem to get away with the murder. It's people on the ground. We need the government support. Without the government support, we really are battling. We cannot make a progress. There are many tourists which come to Botswana. But Botswana, second largest income, foreign income earner, is tourism after the beef. So if it were not for the tourism, Botswana is 1.8 million people. Last year, there were 2 million tourists visited this country. Wow. So it was more than the whole population of the country. But not one tourist ever sits down and write to a president saying, this is what I've seen, this is what I'm unhappy about, you need to look after your wildlife. People just don't do it. People sit and talk. And don't do. Somehow that's in our nature. So if the people also think the pressure on a government is huge, pressure of the public is huge, pressure from the public to say this area cannot be turned into an agriculture area. We cannot take this away from wildlife. Mm. They've already bulldozed down 2,000 hectares not so far away from us because somebody decided to grow a lucerne for sale. Can you imagine what's going to happen to the wildlife going, eating that lucerne, how much it's going to be killed? This is what we need. We need public to show the government that they see that and then they object. And especially people from overseas, which seems to make a huge difference and impact. We have, for that very reason, we have a farmer next door, one of those three who still has a cattle. And he grows 2 hectares of cabbages, some years beetroot. It's nothing. It's nonsense. You can't even call it commercial. I mean, it's of such poor quality as well. But he sells it, all right. He's quite a wealthy man. He's not a poor African person. He's got beautiful air-conditioned house in a local village. He's got butcheries. He's got shops. So you're not also even talking of a very poor person who has a need to eat. Mm-hmm. Every year, because he could not be bothered to electrify his field properly, and that's the only word I can call, he could not be bothered because he could easily do it. But he doesn't want to do it because every year when an elephant breaks in a winter to eat few cabbages, which shouldn't be there at the first place, you are in a wildlife area.
Right.
He has a reason to shoot it. Because there is wildlife services here. They only too happy to give a permission over telephone, which they're not supposed to do. Because then they collect a half a village, which comes immediately, and they chop this elephant to pieces.
Oh, God.
And they take it away in the buckets to have extra meat.
And I heard that they actually use a crane.
Crane, yeah.
And pulled it up by its back
legs.
Oh,
it's horrid.
And was it actually dead by that time? I hope to God or not.
Well, sort of.
Oh, yeah. God.
No, it's horrid. And all authorities, they were there, and I went absolutely berserk because I know law very well. I was involved for years in South Africa, in this at the government level on environmental lawmaking. So I know that while vote this man cannot call this problem animal, because you get a permission if you call it a problem animal, cannot be a problem animal if you have not taken appropriate measures to prevent that animal to becoming a problem animal. So if you've got fence this high for a 3 meter tall elephant,
right,
you have not taken sufficient
So you can't call it a problem animal because you haven't done anything to prevent it from becoming a problem animal.
And that is how it's supposed to be. But we've got elephants going through the back fence, electric fence, which local people don't maintain, or they cut because they want more meat. Every one of those gets shot. They never ever make it back. Or they sell a hunting licenses. This is something I want to mention on your program. From January 2014, our president, Ian Khama, has been enlightened and seen a future far-reaching that he actually outlawed commercial hunting in Botswana.
Right on.
So it's not allowed.
And that's Khama, right?
That's Ian Khama.
I thought that was very interesting. His name was K-H-A-M-A. How interesting is that?
Yeah, he outlawed, he's been very much a hermit. American Hunting Society threatens him and all sorts of things. But he has said, that's it.
Okay.
You have to put him down.
I know. Okay. By the way, everybody, that was a meerkat. And that meerkat was a rescue, and it's amazing. It's adorable. But I think it got freaked out.
Yes, it decided no.
Yeah.
So he was telling you that very, very clearly.
Very
understood.
Yeah, normally he's just very mellow. Anyway, now you've heard of a meerkat.
Yes. So I actually would like to take this opportunity to congratulate this man for his vision.
Fantastic.
Because he's taken a very brave step, and he's really been maligned for that.
So we need to send in not only correspondence to him as well to support what he's doing, because he's really standing on the line.
He has stood up, and it took a lot. They've tried to do it for a while and they really didn't succeed, but this year it became a law, no more commercial hunting of wildlife in Botswana. And furthermore, there used to be things. Every farmer here in Tulu had what they call pot license, which means in the olden days, which perhaps it's understandable, people, there were no shops, there were no nothing. So people live off the land.
Mm-hmm.
So the farmer had a permission to shoot for his needs, not to sell, to eat. But that's, you're going to 1800, 1900. Right. I mean, really, right. We have a supermarkets today, even here. and it was hugely, hugely abused, the spot licenses. There was even a giraffe on it. You could shoot enormous amount of game.
God.
And people did abuse it. We've seen it over and over here again. Well, those spot licenses, until further notice, were also revoked. So nobody is able to go and shoot.
Oh, this is big.
It's big. And it's fantastic.
Yeah.
And this man, I think whole world should congratulate him.
Wow, that's fantastic. Now, is this something that is happening in any other of the other countries?
No. South Africans cling to their hunting and selling game and breeding game. And now they genetically modifying wildlife and breeding black impala and a black springbok golden color wildebeest because the hunters want something more exciting.
Oh my God.
So, I mean, South Africa from conservation point of view is completely rotten.
And you were saying yesterday, Alexandra, you need to understand the history of South Africa. Mm. And what exactly did you mean by that?
Well, South Africa has been governed for a long time now by an Afrikaans government, which was extremely, I can't even find a kind word, to be honest. It was extremely stuck in time and place, in their ideas, on people, on beat an apartheid, which they declared unilaterally, and enforce it for so many years. Mm-hmm. It hasn't changed a lot in a depth of thinking here still. They feel much under the threat in New South Africa. They haven't done everything bad. They've done many good things. I mean, the fact that we have roads, telecommunication, the fact that we had good schools and hospitals built, they all happened under the apartheid, okay? And they were a good thing. Mm-hmm. However, they've had a, and they still do have an incredible need to isolate themselves from the rest of the world. They feel under threat. They feel the Afrikanerdom is under the threat. And to a degree it is, because they've caused themselves so much hatred, especially between black people and white Afrikaans people. There is so much hatred that it's tangible.
So sad.
Which, thankfully, you don't get in Botswana, because Botswana has never been a colony. Botswana's always been a protectorate.
I haven't felt anything
like people
that.
Are wonderful
Botswanan
here.
Botswanan people are precious.
Wonderful.
And I actually enjoy the vendas.
Beautiful people. They have no animosity towards other races. But in South Africa to this day, there is a huge animosity. Mm-hmm. And especially in these rural Afrikaners areas where they've built between themselves animosity. It's very sad because obviously people react on that. There is still a lot of farm murders. They are ongoing all the time.
I did hear about that.
They're not publicized very much because press is not supposed to report in South Africa on killings. But they are happening. So the hatred seemed to go on because obviously now the white Afrikaners, Boers, as they call them, which is a name for a farmer, they're struggling because they are now under siege. Mm-hmm. The black South African people, they want to get even. Mm-hmm. And it's just created this unhealthy situation where nobody's getting better.
And of course, what is the South African government doing to alleviate
nothing,
struggle?
In my opinion.
Yeah.
Really nothing. They're exactly. ignoring it. I think... I believe that it's something which hopefully through generation gets purged out. As new generation come in, mm-hmm. if we manage to succeed to bring them up with less hatred, mm-hmm. there will be more and more tolerance as the time goes on. Yeah. But it has to go for both sides.
Yeah.
And at the moment, neither's given, really. And when you think of it, we're 20 years down in democracy. It's scary. 20 years, that's a new generation
yes.
of people who were not born in apartheid,
right.
of people who can let go of hating
move
each
on.
Other.
Just
move
on,
just move on.
Together.
Yes,
work
exactly.
Together.
Work it out together. So that is the one thing, going back to our move to Botswana, we moved for wildlife. That was our reason. I had a beautiful farm in South Africa as well, one of the most beautiful farm on the north coast.
Nice.
So I've never had an ugly home. I never had a place I would hate if mm-hmm. I'm in South Africa. I loved it. So motivation truly was a wildlife. But now being here for 5 years, I feel so much freer mm-hmm. because you don't meet this hatred here.
Yeah.
The hatred doesn't exist. People are equal. People, you know, treat each other equal. People treat each other with respect. There's no violence. So that was an added benefit, which we didn't realize at the beginning.
And it's almost as if you don't work it out on that level, it really does carry back to the animals, because that hatred is being taken out on them on a daily basis, mm-hmm. which leads me to, I was floored by the story you told me last night about the Zionist. Can you talk a little bit about the people here in Botswana and their so-called religious background and how they see animals fit into that? That was mind-blowing.
I will tell you just a very much on the surface, because I'm not an expert on religion.
Okay.
So I don't know
all the details.
But we are on a big stronghold of Zionist belief in where we live. Julie up to probably Francistan and all the way down to Polokwane. It's a stronghold of Zionist religion in southern Africa. It's not as pure as a Zionist religion from Israel,
okay. Because
it's over the time it has got mixed up with a lot of African witchcraft.
Okay.
And it becomes sort of a mixture which suits them. And sadly so, they torture animals because they sacrifice animals. This is the part of the Zionist religion here. And whatever you do in a church, whatever they pray for, it will always involve some creature being bled to death. And slower it does, the more ancestors will descend in that prayer. Okay. So there are two branches here. I don't know 100% how they differ. One is denominated by Star of David. The other is denominated by Dove of Peace. I don't know how they differ, but they both are extremely orthodox, just like the Zionism in Israel. Very difficult to get through to them if they are Zionists, because if you're not Zionist, you're kind of not part of them. So it's almost like this big clique.
Like a clan.
And
how did they end up here? I mean, how did the whole Zionistic movement end up in the southern part of Africa?
Heavens, no. And really heavens know why they adopted this. They call it a Christianity.
Wow.
I know, it's scary. But
it's so Old Testament.
It is. Very Old Testament. They still go on in a church. My domestic worker is Zionist. Jacob is Zionist. My two people in a camp are Zionist. It's very strong in here. And I have no idea, actually, I should sometime look into it. How did Zionism arrive here? With whom? But it is really strong. And the beliefs, I mean, church completely controls them. Completely, 100%. From giving their bit of money they don't even have to church, to being told everything and anything. One of the sad part about that is that many of them who are HIV positive, many Zionists, followers who are HIV positive, they will not go for treatment because the church says so, it's not good. So they just perish eventually. So it's got a huge power. Zionist church here has a huge, huge power.
That's amazing. And the other thing that's surprising me about what you just said is this is such a humongous variety of not just wildlife, but the trees and the bushes. And you were just talking about the sausage tree yesterday, which you should bring up. You know, and to have all of that at your fingertips, and yet they're not using natural means in which to assist, because I have a firm belief everything is curable. And I've already proven it to myself in many ways. So how, I don't understand how these people, and many of them are walking barefoot, they live on dirt floors, right, in huts. They are tending to their ablutions outside. They go for water in these buckets down the street for their water. There's no sewage. They're completely in touch with the stars, kind of thing. I don't understand how they don't know how to use plants for medicinal means.
They do have a herbalist, and they will buy some herbal medicine. But Zionists, not so much. The people who are not Zionists, they will still go for some herbal medicines. And they do have a herbalist here. Not as much as done in Natal again. In Natal, Zulus are very much into, they have got a witch doctor and they have got a Inyanga. Inyanga is a herbalist. And they are incredibly knowledgeable. I employed the herbalist because I was one time on my farm growing indigenous plants for sale, to herbalists because I was hoping to help to prevent them from removing it from the wild. Mm. So that was the idea. And they are much more into that. Here, I think it's a church which dominates their thinking because they certainly have some very good herbalists. And they certainly know the uses of different trees and plants in combating whatever disease you have. But it's not widely used. They will go to clinic for dispirin.
So shocking to me. And please share with us your experience with the shamans. I think that's a fascinating story.
Which ones we were talking about?
Where you were following them.
Oh, okay. You're talking about Bushmen.
Yes, the Bushmen.
Okay. Oh, it's a long story. I tried to keep it very short.
It's okay.
Once upon the time...
We're doing really well on time. We still have a half hour.
Okay. So. Once upon the time, when it was in the early years coming to South Africa, I was there for 4 years. I just dreamt to see the bush. And I couldn't. I had no money. I couldn't travel. I had to kind of... make sure I eat every day, never mind travel. That was the last on the agenda. And but I yearned to go in a wilderness because I still haven't seen a wilderness. I've seen Pretoria, Johannesburg, and Durban.
Oh, my God.
I mean, that's just like, you know. So I also looked for a job. It took me 4 years to find one. And I just found one. And I got a friend who called me and said, I saw advert in the newspaper. And we used to sit with dictionary every evening trying to go through different adverts. And there was an advert, it was a National Geographic expedition. It was a linguistic expedition. They were coming to study a Bushman language.
Wow, fascinating.
And the camp attendant, a chef, cook, come camp cleaner, had a motor car accident 3 or 4 days before they were leaving. And they now had nobody. So put an advert in to say if they could find somebody in a hurry. Well, I dropped my new job. I haven't even started.
Oh, my God.
And told them I can do the
After
job.
After 4 years of looking for one.
Yeah, after 4 years. My friend who helped me to find this job was furious with me for a couple of years afterwards. But I said, I can cook. I can do this job. Can you leave? 3 days' time. Yes, I'm ready. And I went.
Oh, my God.
They were there only for 3 months. Okay.
Only?
By the time we got into middle of a Kalahari, and you're going back to... late 70s, early 80s. It was a hell of a journey.
I bet.
So by the time they found out that I can't even boil water, it was too late to do anything with me. They couldn't send me back. They didn't have enough vehicles. They were a great bunch of people, and it was agreed kind of, well, what can you do? I said, well, not a lot, but yes, I'll clean, and if you help me. There was one guy who could cook, so he helped me. And I eventually stayed. And I just cleaned the camp and cooked what I could. The poor people were long-suffering, I promise you. I was never much into a kitchen, so my cooking skills were zero and below. Anyhow, they all stoically suffered me for 3 months. We somehow managed to get by and got very friendly. And even with just being in a camp while they were out all day, it was fantastic. There was so much wildlife. Bushmen were still living absolutely free as they used to where we were in central Kalahari. I loved it.
Fantastic.
3 months' time, we packed up. And we now coming back to South Africa. And they were going to fly back to America. And before we reached the border in Botswana and by the Francis time we were coming down, I thought, no, I'm not going home. Going home to what? Do you need me? I didn't have anybody. I didn't have a family to go back to. I didn't have anybody. So I hitched a ride with a donkey cart and a foot, and I ran away. But it was not that funny at the beginning because being there alone, I went back to the same Bushman clan. But being there alone, beside people who've had everything, tea, coffee, milk, sugar, and all this, it's quite a different story. And I promise you the first month for sure, I thought I'm going to die there. That's it.
Why do you say that?
I wasn't fit enough to follow these people. Even though I was young and slim and fairly athletic, I was nowhere near fit enough. They walk 20 kilometers, 25 kilometers a day in a soft sand. You know what that does to your ankles?
Yes.
In a heat of 40 degrees, 42 in a shade. They don't eat all day. They eat just after sunrise and after sunset. And they don't drink all day. It was so tough. I cannot explain how tough it was. But you do get fitter every day. Months later, I still thought I'm going to die, but I thought less when I'm coming back.
What did you do for water?
Well, I had to wait until they all eventually break the camp, and then everybody was offered a bit of water. And they take 2-3 sips, whereby, you know, I wanted to drink 3 liters. But you don't get given. Oh, so it's God. Really, it was hard.
Oh my
but eventually, I transcend through that, and I really loved it being there. I worked with the women. I dug the tubers. I did the fire. I battled with the food. So then because they don't cook anything, Bushmen just kind of woofs it over the fire. So it's war. And I couldn't eat it, but I mean, you have to eat something. I weighed 49 kilograms when I left the Kalahari. Wow. Did me world of good.
So exactly what do they survive off of?
Mostly a tubers, mostly a vegetative matter, and then meat.
Okay.
And in summer, they collect some wild fruit, berries, their wild raisins. They have some nama melons, which taste absolutely awful to us. But, I mean, they roast the seeds and make it in a porridge and make it into, you can use the powdered seeds. It a little bit tastes like coffee, very vaguely.
Wow. And they don't eat very much.
They don't eat a lot at all. Except if they, summer they stay in one area because there's enough food. Meat they can eat plenty. Bushmen's got this extendable stomach and they like a lamb. They can eat 8 kgs, 5 kgs of meat in one shot.
And how do they catch their meat?
A poison arrow, and they go hunting. Yeah.
Interesting. So it's like the American Indians back in the
old days. Yes. And then eventually the dream had to come to end. And
the dream?
I loved it.
But it must have been fantastic.
And I, to this day, regret that I didn't stay long enough. But then I had another problem. I was here illegally because I didn't had I had a visa for 3 months.
Oh, my God.
I should have crossed the border. So I had to illegally walk on foot and cross the border.
God.
Yeah, it was a bit of a mission. But it was easy in those days because, well, it's still easy today. People just walk across. There's no border per se. Except where you're crossing. There they make a gate and a route and you've got to show your passport. But anywhere else to this day, in most of Africa, people just walk across. So I did the same.
So what do you feel was the most major thing that you learned from that experience, being with the Bushmen that long period of time?
You know, I learn spirituality, but in a different kind of sense. I learn how precious it is to be alive. I learn how special it is to see a sunrise every morning.
Awesome.
I learn how special it is that there is a society which never read the Bible, but lives a holy life.
Mm.
I learned that we've got a lot to learn from so-called savages. I've learned to be humble.
And gratitude, I would imagine.
I've learned the gratitude. I've learned to appreciate lots of things which I wouldn't have known at that youth. And I was given it very early in my life, for which I will be eternally grateful.
Now, you were how old when you did this?
I was 24.
What an life-changing experience, right?
It was. It was.
And would that have accelerated your connection to the wildlife?
I think so. Positively, yes. And I've That's one of my very few regrets in life, that I didn't stay longer. And you know why? We women do stupid things.
Why?
I got married.
Oh, you did that.
I did that. So
that.
The husband rule, where are we going to live?
Oh my gosh, that's too funny.
So falling in love is not always a good thing. It was a good thing then, but I think it was a mistake in my case, because I should have actually gone back and I should have pursued that wonderful soul fulfilling experience.
Oh my,
I shouldn't have left it that early. There was still a time I needed in there, and I just didn't do it.
That's amazing. Now, do the people respect the Bushmen? Are there a lot of them?
No. Here in Botswana, people very much malign the Bushmen. Mm-hmm. Again, the president affords them tremendous protection.
Good.
Because rightly so. The government say the Bushmen were here first, and they were. Before Bantusan people, mm-hmm. the Bushmen were the original occupiers of this land.
Mm-hmm.
But to this day, it's like your American Indians. Bushmen just doesn't seem to fit in a society. They have been forced to try to adopt our ways, which is not working. They live in villages where there is not much futures. They do a lot of drinking because they're battling to fit. And today, there may be only about 300 left living a life of there's more Bushmen, but the ones which live the traditional life,
okay.
There's very few in the central Kalahari, still in central Kalahari areas. But it is a sad case, the Bushmen, but it's somehow not a success story, because although the government is trying, they're giving them financial support, they're giving them food, they get free schooling and a medical. They're trying to bring them up, but those people's heart is in a different place.
Sure, and they don't belong in that that traditional culture or anything. It's exactly what's happened with the American Indian story.
It's just, I mean, there are some which perhaps filter out of that, but bulk of them just don't belong, and they want to live different kind of life. So we have this lot of transitions here, which are very painful, mm-hmm. and the damage seems to just go on and on and on.
Is there a workshop or seminar or training program that bridges the knowledge of the Bushmen with, you know, somebody who's interested in becoming more in touch with the environment? And, you know, because you read a lot about how the Bushmen communicate with the animals telepathically.
Mm.
You know, you read about how they live off the land. Mm. And these are the types of things I personally feel we are really actually on a very mass scale level, whether we accept it or not, we are moving back to that. Because we're realizing that the way all this that we've been sold is not really fulfilling our hearts and our souls.
Definitely not. As far as I know, there is no such program, which is a pity.
Yeah. Are you still in touch with them?
No, no. Lawrence van der Post wrote a number of publications about the Bushmen. He was very close to them spiritually, and tried to portray to the world the life of the Bushmen. I tell you what is interesting. To me, what was most interesting of all of this, how we differ in our thinking. Even a very hungry Bushman family, if they come and they could be starving, they come across the plant which is edible, and there's five of these plants growing. They will take two, maximum three. If they're really desperate, they will always leave the two.
So
what do we do? We take the whole five, sell it two, and eat three. That's a mentality of
greed.
The Western world.
Yeah.
And that is something which it was good for me to see early in my life, that respect and understanding of an environment, that you can live in it, but you need to leave a portion of it alone.
Mm-hmm.
You need to respect some of it. that it is entitled to its space mm-hmm. and be whatever it is. You're not entitled to utilize it just because you human being think that you're on top of the food chain.
Yes.
And that was very clear on dealing with a bushman. And that's very clear to me on a society as such that, and we see it here with the young people coming in here, that this consumer society, people put themselves first at all the time. At all the time.
That is just a travesty. Is there any way that we can communicate with the Bushmen? You know, I mean, are they readily available for those that want to bridge that gap?
I think they are. They would.
Do they speak English?
Not many, no. Yeah, no. But you can see there are places here which are holy places of a Bushman which you can visit, which are awesomely spiritual, which are truly a places where you feel the souls.
Yeah.
And you feel the power. Yes. You feel this power of spirituality. They are sacred places. You can visit them. There are some places which still have Bushman villages, sadly so, and this is a problem. You will find them with a Coca-Cola t-shirt on, because when people come here, they think if they want to give something to people, they must give them something like that.
Coca-Cola.
T-shirt, yes. A Coca-Cola can. Or lighters, which when they run out of gas, they throw them in a desert because what they want to do with them.
Right.
So, you know, it's this arrogance of us people as well, tourists, the visitors, whoever, that we don't actually think of the people we came to have a look at, how they live.
Yeah.
We don't respect their environment. Right. We don't respect perhaps the lack of their resources or knowledge. We just come to see and conquer. That's people. I start my lectures by saying, of all the animals on this planet, the people are the only one who are not endangered. We are aggressive. We take over. We are intelligent. We can dominate each other. We are hostile. We are not endangered.
I think there's been such a move on a global scale within so many major cities around the world that are opening their eyes and waking up to the reality that we have given away our power to the governments. We have allowed them to make decisions that are not based on the benefit of humanity, and therefore that has carried itself out to the disharmony and disadvantage of the wildlife. And so I think, you know, more than any other time, this is a time that we have got to unify. And I would love, you know, please provide them any other, you know, task that you feel would be of benefit to help this cause. Because I know it's not just South Africa, but if I haven't learned anything else from being here, I've learned that this truly is like no other place in the world.
I think so.
I mean, there's just no question about it. I was in a riverbed yesterday along Solomon's Wall, and I walked by a crocodile, and I'm thinking, and I saw the crocodile. I mean, for a Californian,
yes.
I'm like sitting there going, whoa, okay. And it started coming out of the water. I said, okay, I'm going to respect you. I walked away. Mm. My heart was beating a little bit. I thought, no, it's good. I look over in the distance, and there's this huge elephant, you know. And
lovely.
I mean, I'm standing in the middle of this place going, my God, where else can I go to be in this kind of environment?
To do that.
And that they're just living peacefully with us.
But you know what the people must realize, I believe, is that how powerful we are in a way of money. If you have money today, even a $1, you're immensely powerful because you can choose how to spend a dollar. We have an internet where most people can actually find out anything and everything about anybody. It's so bad that we've lost the privacy.
Yes.
Now, I say to my students, You can change the world just by thinking how you're going to spend that $1. Who are you going to support? Check on people. Check mm-hmm. on company. Check on people who do good thing. Check on people who don't do good thing mm-hmm. for wildlife and environment. Don't support them. Don't buy their product.
And don't
give them the power, because if there's no money in it, they go down.
Yes.
They are not going to exist, because nobody is going to exist if they're not making a living.
Well, and that brings up another point, which is I had interviewed another gentleman, Rupert, and he's a safari tour guide mm. who kind of carries in the spiritual connection mm. to mm. The environment, and talks about things like spiders that we all are mostly creeped out about. Mm. But then you start hearing about the complexities of a spider and mm. you trip out. You know, it's just like, wow, look how much we can learn just from a spider. His whole thing was, don't make just the assumption to just donate your money to, you know, these supposed conservancy groups that are at the tip top, owned by some of the darker agendas, unfortunately. Mm. So do you have any comments on that?
100% comments on that. Don't give your money to anybody who you haven't checked out. There is so much. The charity, be it a human or animal, is a big business. It's a business. People make a living out of it. Mm. It's in their interest to keep it going, because they lose a living if it's not going. So there is so much bad thing. And a problem is that most people who come to Africa, they feel somewhat guilt for seeing a poverty they do. So they think they're going to fix it by giving money somebody. It appeases that person.
Right.
It buys, they buy their conscience.
Right.
Because they're actually not making any difference. So there is a little rule of thumb you can use. First of all NGOs, which is a non-governmental organization, has to be registered. By having, you can Google each organization and check on the registration number. If they have it, it means their books have to be audited.
Okay.
It's not foolproof. Nothing's foolproof on this life. Sure. But it's some good level of assurance that they are doing the right thing with your money. Then you have to be careful. By law, every non-governmental organization is only required to spend 10% of the donation in a direct course. What it means, if you give me $10, I can spend $1 feeding this animal. I can spend $9 in administration.
Mm. Oh, wow.
Now, what's administration? I need a new car. I need a new computer.
Oh, wow.
I need a camera to do my work.
Really,
I need a new office. I need a new carpet. My office is in my house, so I need an extension, and so on. There is a lot of space for abuse.
Wow.
So what you
really
need to do...
proportion.
Yeah, it is. But that's what's happening. It's a big business. Mm. People who do a human welfare in Mozambique, they come with the whole family and they stay in a 5-star hotel for 6 months, and welfare organization is paying the bill.
Mm.
Whereby if you really want to do good, go and live in a village
mm-hmm.
with those people and learn a lot more about them, because you're not going to learn well from the 5-star hotel in a town.
Or go and volunteer with someone like yourself, where you're really
absolutely on the ground,
day-to-day basis of what's needed, what's being called for, how they can be protected.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So there is a way to protect yourself against giving your money to something which is not worthwhile. You can Google these organizations, and they are obliged by law to provide you with their balance sheets.
Now, what about some of the organizations that we are aware of that we're finding out, because this is a big fear of a lot of people that want to assist, is we're hearing more and more and more that that money never even made
it to that
organization.
Most of them don't.
If people have questions about this, would you be willing to field those questions?
I would, yes, because it's something which I really dislike.
Okay.
Because if you look at the balance sheets, you just look at the expenditure. You ask for expenditure. They have to give it to you. Anybody who spends more than 60%, 50% in fact, on administration, you don't give money to. You want to see Some organizations spend 100% in direct costs, and they mm-hmm. fund their organ or their administration from something else.
Right.
But most of them, you need to pay salaries. People need to earn a living. Nobody does it for free anymore. Fair enough. But anybody who spends more than 50% in administration, I wouldn't give a money to.
And do you find that it's the smaller organizations, or you know,
bigger than two?
Like, I'm thinking right off the bat, World Wildlife
Fund.
Well,
if you look what mess the World Wildlife is in, you have to see that they haven't done a good job.
Yeah.
They never follow anything through.
Point.
I mean, look at the mess we are in. We're losing wildlife. Hugely so. If you look at a statistic for just over the last 50 years, we've lost bulk of our wildlife, and a trend is continuing. Nothing is being slowed down or stopped. In fact, it's getting worse. So I have to ask myself a question. Where is World Wildlife Fund?
Mm. So I would say the best place to come is to Wild at Thule, wouldn't you?
Yes, I hope we would attract people who could help us. We need help. It's just a two people, maybe two crazy people, just Judy and myself.
And you're working around the clock. Every time I've come here, you guys are really needing some assistance. And let me tell you, for all of you out there that are really trying to find your own niche, if you're like myself, where animals have always been a very soft spot in your heart, such as myself, these guys really need your help. So if you are willing to assist them, please visit their website at www.wildattuli.com. And you can also drop Helena an email at Helena, which is Helena, at wildattuli.com. And Judy, her partner, is Judi at wildattuli.com. So I can't thank you enough for the immense amount of dedication that you've shown, and I just don't want you to give up, because we are at the final hour, and I'm sure there's going to be people out there that have heard this recording today that really do want to help you, and you do have people behind you.
So, thank you. It does make a job a little bit easier to know that we're not entirely crazy, and that we are having a people out there who perhaps think like us,
yes,
and want the same thing. And I do believe what you said in pyramid effect, and I do believe that if the people could unite and more people thinking alike get together, perhaps we will finally get somewhere.
Yeah, and I would also put a request out to anybody out there that's willing to fund, because Steve's and my project definitely involves this sort of thing. If you're willing to put a donation out or speak to any of us, we could all work together, because I feel very strongly that I want to assist you in any way I can through the Galactic Connection.
Thank you, Alex. Also, talking about a donation, we are very happy to have a very specific, so people can actually see the result. It doesn't have to be sucked into what we do. Mm-hmm. But we may have, like, we're really desperately trying to build a dam, which is very badly needed for this area, for wildlife.
And they need the water.
They need the water.
I definitely noticed that.
So it would be specific if the people say, okay, I wish to contribute to this dam, or I wish to contribute to keeping the electric fence going, because we don't want those elephants being shot out there. So it can be onto a very specific, which can be checked out, and people can see the result. This way, I feel ethically and morally much more at comfort to accept money.
That'd
so I would like it to be for specifics, and there are many specific, many needs. There is the compensation to the farmer, so we hopefully prevent these animals being poisoned and trapped. So it can be a direct help.
Well, so everybody, you've heard this. I think this is a fascinating radio program. And again, please visit galacticconnection.com. Your assistance and your donations to us, where we provide a free blog each day, and also a weekly radio show, these sorts of things, and our server and everything else, it does cost us money. So are really starting to ask for donations. I've never really been that big about doing it, but now my direction is going in another area, and I really am wanting to get out there and make a difference even more so. So thanks, everyone, for listening. Thank you so much, Helena, for all your time and your work. And we love you. We love all of you out there, and we look forward to hearing from you soon. Take care.
Thank you.
Then you are welcome. Bye-bye.